Here's what you can look forward to in today's episode.
We know that human interaction touch points are the ones that have the most impact. And when people are living the brand and experiencing it, so, you know, if we think of pop-ups like the Magnum Pleasure Store, those have such a big impact on the people that go and on the news that spreads. And I think we'll find more creative, experiential retail environments in order to attract people into them. And then the convenience shopping will obviously be much more digitally focused.
Over the last decade, the market research industry has been disrupted. Our largest agencies are struggling to keep up as their customers turn to newer, faster, and cheaper data sources. Now, we are on the edge of yet another major market shift. Now is the time for us to reassert ourselves as the rudder of the brands we love. Thank you for tuning in to the Happy Market Research Podcast, where we are charting the path for the future of market researchers and businesses. Hi, I'm Jamin Brazil, and you're listening to the Happy Market Research Podcast. Today, my guest is Fiona Blades, President and CEO, that's Chief Experience Officer, of Mesh Experience. Mesh specializes in identifying how your brand is experienced by your customers. Prior to founding Mesh, Fiona has worked at several agencies, including Leo Burnett. Fiona, thanks very much for being on the Happy Market Research Podcast today.
My pleasure. I'm delighted to be on it.
So today you're in New York City. Your accent suggests perhaps you came from someplace else. Could you tell us a little bit about your childhood and your journey towards market research?
Of course, I'd be delighted. And yes, my accent is a little bit of a giveaway. I started in the UK, and it's interesting that you actually asked me how I actually started in life, because although I was working in London for my whole career before I moved to New York, I actually come from the north of England, and my parents lived near Manchester in Cheshire. And so that was where I grew up when I was young. It's very friendly. It's very different. And many people wouldn't know that I actually have come from the north because my accent sounds more like a southern UK person.
That is awesome. So what did your parents do?
Well, it was interesting that you've asked the question because actually, when I set up Mesh, I said, how on earth could I have set up this agency? You know, what led me? What was in my genes to get here? And then I thought about it. And my father was an engineer and he actually owned a business. So I thought, well, maybe, you know, that's part of what led me to where I am now. And in particular, he had something called a mold engraving business. So he put the textures or the designs onto plastics that might go onto cars, for example. But he invented processes. And I thought back about that. And I thought, I wonder whether he was good at inventing processes and whether that led me to think about how I could come up with a new process for market research to capture people's experiences in real time. So that was my father. And then on the other side, my mother had a nightclub. She owned an indie nightclub in Manchester for over 20 years during the period when it was called Madchester. So that was the Oasis period and those kind of songs. And I think what I really got from my mother when I went to her club, and I did only go once because obviously that was her place, it was just an amazing experience for me because I saw the teamwork. I saw how her members of staff felt that it was their club and they showed me around and they worked so efficiently. And I just hoped that one day that I would be able to have a company where people bonded so well together and were all doing something that they loved. So I think I got something very different out of both of my parents.
Was your mother particularly outgoing? I'd imagine in that environment, that would be helpful.
She was outgoing. But what was funny was that she never let on that it was her club. So she was on the door and she would take the money in on the door. She was over 50 before she started the club. And so she never had her name kind of publicly associated with it. which was very interesting. She was much more the person that was doing the business side, making sure everything ran smoothly, making sure all the staff was there, that the licensing was in place. And then she had other people. She had a manager who would be helping with the promoting and the marketing, making sure the right DJs were there. So obviously it was part of a team. But yes, she was outgoing, but no, she was not the public face of a Manchester nightclub during a period where there was clearly a lot of crime and difficulty. So it was a very unusual position for a woman of her age to be an owner and there every night at a nightclub.
That is fascinating. The fearlessness, right, of being in the door person that takes the money. I mean, you're also dealing or being exposed to people that you may not want to service, in which case they've got to find another place to go, which can be a difficult conversation, I would imagine.
I think so. But do you know, she had somebody who was her doorman for over 20 years, Theo. I think everyone thought it might have been Theo's club. And he was big because he was the bouncer. But what was funny was at the end of the evening, there were literally carrier bags of cash. And Theo would carry these carrier bags out to the car with my mother. And I think that people just thought, well, she was a little old woman. So they didn't know she got a car stashed with cash.
That is hilarious. That's hilarious. That's a great visual, especially at, 3, 4 a.m., I can imagine, in the morning. Anyway, so the connection, but for me, that's interesting, and you've already pointed this out, is that process-oriented mentality that both of your parents had and then ultimately installed in you. Maybe you could tell us a little bit about what the impetus was for you starting Mesh Experience.
Well, the impetus in many ways was because I was working as a planning director at Clayton Healy, and I had account planning people reporting into me, coming up with creative ideas, the proposition that they then worked on with the creatives, and also the data team that were analyzing the data. And one of our clients was Mercedes-Benz. And I knew that it wasn't just the TV ad that made somebody buy a Mercedes-Benz. It was looking online. It was seeing your neighbor's car and thinking, wow, I think I want to know a bit more about that car. It could have been seeing Top Gear and seeing a car that was featured on that. And I just felt that we needed a way to understand every different experience that someone was having with the brand in order that we could then work out which experiences there needed to be more of and which we needed to get rid of. And there wasn't anything. I think you mentioned fearless in relation to my mother, and I think that's partly true for me. If I'd known about market research, I would have known that you can't do market research on a mobile phone using text messaging. But I didn't know that in 2005. I just thought, well, you can use a mobile phone to collect data. And I had data people reporting in. And why can't you use SMS? So from that, I developed an approach, which we called real-time experience tracking, in order to actually find out what experiences people were having with brands. And in many ways, it was a little bit like a CRM program. So coming from a direct marketing and agency background, I knew that, first of all, you sent one letter, then an email, then you had a phone call. There were these different things and you had to keep people engaged. And in a way, I suppose that influenced the process because I wanted people to tell us about what it was like when they saw the TV ad, but then they saw a poster, then they might have had a conversation, then they looked online. So I wanted them to tell us all those experiences as they were having them and to keep them engaged in the process. So I think there were some parts of what I'd done in my previous role that really helped develop that process.
Yeah, the real life application or need. There is this amazing brilliance with being blind to the barriers. This has come up with a few other entrepreneurs I've had on the show. Them not knowing that you couldn't do that or that the industry had said you couldn't do it. And then they wind up actually executing particularly well and creating a major point of differentiation in the market. The point about measuring the impact on every step of the user journey, and I'll put every in quotation marks because that's tricky, but at least at the points of exposure, That's something that Amazon, of course, has capitalized on particularly well and continues to exploit. And I don't mean that in a, you know what I mean, they continue to leverage for their benefit. Are you seeing your work starting to move more and more in that positioning? So in other words, you know, evening the playing field against the digital giants?
I think things have changed so much since we set up the agency in 2006, and it's absolutely fascinating. And I love the direction that things are going in. I mean, if you think about it, in 2006, when we first set up in January, there was no Twitter, for example. We weren't really talking as an industry about social media and social media listening. Now there is just a wealth of digital data that we can mine that is in real time, that gives us information about people's behavior. And for me, that's all about real-time data. And that's where I came from when I was thinking about mesh and real-time experience tracking. I suppose what we've done over the 12 years is we really understand our data set. And from that, we've been able to create models. So we have an experience model. We have a manifesto for experience-driven marketing. So we created that as well. And we find that looking through the customer's eyes in the way we do, and the data is self-reported. So it's not the same actually as some of the passive data collection, which I really like passive data collection, but it's not quite the same. But it does pick up every touch point. And, you know, maybe some of the digital touch points, we're not getting some of the real time kind of in-person touch points it might be missing on. But this almost provides the glue through which you can then look at all these other different data sources and make sense of them. So one question we often ask marketing directors is, we'll say, can you draw a pie chart of where you're spending money for your brand? And of course they can draw that pie chart. That's really easy. But then we say, right, now draw that pie chart of how people are experiencing your brand. And that's much more difficult, because what percentage of those experiences are seeing a TV ad? What percentage are drinking the product? What percentage are seeing somebody else drink the product, or seeing it on a shelf in the supermarket or at home? And that's much more difficult, but that's the pie chart that our data can draw for marketing directors.
I mean, there's two things there that stand out to me, but one is, you know, before 2006 or 2007, really, which is the whole mobile phenomenon. Brand and social phenomenon. Brands used to be who they said they were, and now they really are who the customers say they are, given the socialization of that and influence of those comments. In fact, we're going through a remodel in our house right now, and my wife is literally looking at Yelp reviews as the number one way to identify who we're going to source different projects with. And it's quite a bit of different vendors that we're going through right now, just through that process. And a few of the vendors that we wound up saying no to had really high Yelp reviews. However, the referral that we got was to somebody else who just simply didn't manage against that. And, you know, they're stuck with they just don't care about social, and they just are stuck with the two people that said something negative about that experience. The impetus now is on the brands to actually measure that customer experience, because as soon as the person viscerally connects, positive or negative, then they have the means by which to influence everybody else's view of that brand.
Even when we started, I got a vision of what I called brand dialogue at the time. And very early on in 2007, we were very lucky to work with Unilever for Axe, the male body spray. And I remember there, we were picking up a campaign that they were running called Boom Chicka Wawa, which was a great campaign. And they wanted to see how quickly that catchphrase would catch on. And what we could see in the feedback that people were giving to us was they were playing with it. So I remember one photograph of Facebook where somebody put their status as feeling very bow chicka wow wow today. And, you know, those kind of things, we were thinking, right, well, if that's, you know, I'd love to be able to be in a situation where a brand can be responding quickly and picking up on the consumer conversation and taking that along. And in 12 years, we're now much closer to that.
100%. The other thing that starts standing out to me is how the user journey has evolved. You know, prior to online, which I am old enough to know really, really well, there was this, you know, set architecture where people could spend ad, or brands could spend ad dollars, TV, radio, billboards, etc. And then, as we know, the internet added another channel, social adding another channel. As you look forward to voice, how are you seeing that play out from a user journey perspective and that ultimately rolling up to your brands?
I mean, I think voice is fascinating, and I mustn't mention the A word or we'll get stuff happening here, like blinds closing and lights going on. As far as we're concerned with our particular methodology, so the core one we use, and we do have, you know, a number of others that we work with as well, but we ask people to tell us whenever they see, hear, or experience anything. So we pick up any touch point, whether that is voice or not. I mean, sometimes, for example, we know we have a big retail banking study in the UK. There you can see that maybe an experience could have been that somebody's been chatting online about their bank account. Whether or not they're chatting to a chatbot or a real person, sometimes that's difficult to know, but I suspect that they don't know either. But certainly, I think voice is just a whole new, exciting dimension of data.
I read a statistic recently from Purina, which is, they do a lot of things, one of which is dog food or pet food. The statistic was, their projections are that about 50% of their revenue will be purchased through digital assistants like the A word or Google Home or whatever over the next 5 years. That statistic for me really speaks volumes and the importance of nailing the consumer connection over that period of time, because after, right, once people move to Alexa order paper towels from a purchase perspective. Oh, sorry. Alexa, stop. I think I just ordered a bunch of paper towels. So you wind up in this tough situation where purchase choice is being controlled, obviously at the user level, but the user isn't processing the connection of the name of that brand with the product in the way that we do with Kleenex, right? It just becomes critical. Like if I was a major brand right now, I'd be thinking, what does that user journey look like? What does the experience look like? And then how is it going to map once 50% of my revenue moves to a voice-based purchase journey?
I mean, again, I think you're absolutely right with that. In fact, I started my career on pet food. I was a marketing manager on dog food, on brands called Winalot and Bonio and Shapes and Winalot Prime in the UK many years ago. And it was such a different world then. We created a 60-second ad. It was the first 60-second award-winning IPA,
nice,
award-winning ad for dog food at the time. And now just look at how things have changed. Obviously, you know, particularly with something like pet food, it's heavy. You don't want to be lugging it around. Of course, you know, you'll want it delivered. The whole user journey is going to be different. With something like dog food as well, of course, you've got both the purchaser and you've got the dog. So you've got a whole load of other dynamics going on, which I think are interesting and a lot around the emotional relationship. So there may be something to do with the purchase experience and the choice of dog food that relates to that relationship. So you'll need to find moments where you can change behavior, because quite often things are habitual and they're bought on, you know, over and over again. But let's say the dog is ill. That's a good opportunity for change. What's going to happen then? Where is somebody going to go? What are they going to look at online, and how can your brand influence? So I think there will be some very different purchase journeys that we'll see.
Yeah. Gosh, that's so, I would love to spend, I know you have a call in an hour, so I'm not going to spend the next 3 hours talking about this subject, but I what you just said is super interesting for me. The reason why is because the consumer journey is exponentially changing, right? Year over year over year, as technology is disrupting that or redefining that journey. You know, you can see the rise, and I'm not going to say fall, but the move away from Snapchat as an example, all in and then all out, and it just changed. And that environment and the context of the platform changes how the brand needs to position itself in order to be relevant and interesting to that population. And to your point, there are only a few inflection points that impact behavioral change in a consumer purchase pattern. And you've got to be relevant there. So then you have to think about, all right, how am I influencing that journey? And a big part of that is, where are they finding the information, right, that informs, that pulls the value for, or puts the value forward to them? And you need to be that as a brand. You need to be that single source, or as much as you certainly can be. So anyway, really interesting subject.
Absolutely. And I think the kind of the other, almost like the flip side of what we've been discussing, is retail bricks and mortar and the move from being transactional to experiential. There's going to be loads more, of course, that will be done online. But from our work that we've done over the years, we know that human interaction touch points are the ones that have the most impact. And when people are living the brand and experiencing it, so, you know, if we think of pop-ups like the Magnum Pleasure Store, those have such a big impact on the people that go and on the news that spreads. And I think we'll find more creative, experiential retail environments in order to attract people into them. And then the convenience shopping will obviously be much more digitally focused.
So you're a successful entrepreneur. I'm an entrepreneur, have been for the last almost 2 decades. We both know, anybody that's been doing this for any period of time, they go through highs and lows. Would you tell us a little bit about one of the largest challenges that you experienced starting and building your company, and then how you addressed it?
There was a moment during the recession, 2008-09, that was particularly challenging. We'd started in 2006. Let's remember that I'd had that blissful ignorance and thought that I could set this up. And all of a sudden, the economy changed. We'd only just set up an office in Singapore and privately funded business. But we'd had, you know, major clients saying we're interested in particular in China at the time. And we were able to service Europe and the States out of our London office, but we really couldn't service Asia out of London. So we thought, right, we'll go to Singapore. No sooner had we set up the Singapore office, I remember that we'd been at the Market Research Society annual awards event in 2008, and we'd won more awards than any other agency. And of course, we were only 2 years old. We were, you know, this was so exciting for us. And we were looking into the new year, and all these clients had said that they were going to be working for us, and they got these campaigns. And literally, January came, and every single client got back to us, and they said, "I'm so sorry, our budgets have been cut. Well, our campaign's moving. We're not going to do anything." We literally had nothing coming in January, nothing coming in February, a tiny amount coming in March. And I had to get hold of our managing director in Singapore and say, "We can't send any more money out to you. Can you just get back to me and let me know what to do?" And the next day he phoned and he said, "Right, okay, I have looked at this and I can halve our costs." And I nearly fell off my chair. I thought, I don't know how they're going to be able to halve their costs. What are they going to do? So I said, "Well, I'm all ears, you know, tell me what you can do." He said, "We're going to move to Thailand." And I said, "Right, okay. He said, not forever, but we're going to move now to Thailand. And that's what they did. So I suppose that I've learned from others. I wouldn't have come up with that idea myself. But I'm delighted to say that although that particular person left Mesh afterwards, today we are still working with him as a consultant in that region. So I think it's kind of really being tenacious and listening to other people, because other people have got great ideas and expertise to bring.
And the point that you made about you still have a relationship with that individual who helped you navigate that very difficult point in time, that's key, right? Because that is exactly your DNA, and even expressed in how your customers' customers or the customers of the brands it need to and want to interact, right? And is it Casper? I might be mistaken on the brand, but a digital mattress brand that's opening stores. Obviously, Warby Parker, which we've all heard about, moving from exclusively online to opening up brick and mortar. So you definitely have the success at a digital level not being enough, and needing to then enable the customer to have this full immersive experience in order to maintain that relationship.
I mean, we believe that experiences needs to go into everything that we do. So, I mean, obviously we're understanding clients, the brand experiences that their customers are having. But most of us have experience in our titles, and that's because we want to ensure that our clients have great experiences working with us, that our participants in studies, we never call them respondents, they're always participants, because we want them to have a good experience. We want our partners that we work with to have a good experience. This is an ecosystem, and we really believe that it's important to, you know, to walk the walk and talk the talk as well. You know, that we need to be thinking about the touch points we have with our partners, and to try and make those great experiences rather than negative ones.
So what do you see as the characteristics of an all-star employee? What do you look for what do you seek to install in your team?
The first thing is a can-do spirit. If you are coming into a smaller, more entrepreneurial business, you need somebody that loves that they want to do things and they've got that can-do spirit. They also need to be creative problem solvers as well, because you just don't know what's going to happen. We talked about the radical transformation that's gone on over the last 12 years. So you need somebody who can think about problems creatively. And I think the third thing is an empathetic team player. I see the difference between when a team is functioning well and when it's functioning less well. And it's always about the teamwork. You can have the greatest people, but how can you make them gel? So having somebody who is a good team player, who is empathetic and understands other people and can work out how they can excel with everybody else, I think is really important.
Do you have a specific example of someone on your team that may have exhibited that? And if so, a time where they did?
Yes. I mean, our regional lead in Sao Paulo, Marcello Garitano, he is a great example, I think, of this. He started working at Mesh in the UK. He then set up the office in Brazil. There were tough times in Brazil as well, and we had to shut the office. We then won a major pitch and reopened it again very, very quickly. And all the time, he was resilient. He was able to build a fantastic team, and he has some of the most diverse pieces of business going through his office. I was there last week. And, you know, there are many, many different types of things, not just our real-time experience tracking, but on some clients is purely working as consultants, using their data, coming up with new tools for them. And he often is given our global projects because of his ability to manage a great team.
So as a successful entrepreneur who has weathered more than a few storms, what do you see as one of your keys to success?
I think if you were talking kind of attitudinally, I think what I'd say is energy, optimism, and resilience. In a way, I almost think that if you knew what it was going to be like having a business, you probably wouldn't set one up. So you've got to really love it. And I think you need your own purpose. So for Mesh, we've set something which is about helping to create and measure experiences that grow brands, people, and society. And that bit of society is important to me. You know, there has to be a reason why you're doing something. And so I think having a sense of what you're really trying to achieve is important and keeps you going and keeps you motivated.
I think it's Eric Ries that said one of my favorite tweets of all time, actually, if a company doesn't have a vision, they are just wandering around. And you're exactly right. You've got to have a reason why. So operating at sort of that, whether it's 10 or 30,000 feet, maybe even a little bit higher, from your viewpoint, what are you seeing as a trend in the marketing and marketing research space?
Well, we've talked about some of those trends, but one I'm really pleased about, I think, is that experience is coming of age. So again, maybe 10 to 12 years ago, I don't remember it being talked about as much. But now it feels as though everybody's talking about it. And I was really delighted to see in an article a little while ago in Harvard Business Review, where the authors that included Keith Weed from Unilever were talking about how share of voice and share of wallet wouldn't be the key metrics for the future. It would be share of experience. I feel delighted that we're here at this time, because I think there's a time and a place. And now it does feel as though people are really valuing experience.
I mean, it's so far beyond anything else, really, right? I mean, one technology company that I can't divulge who they are, but they have not been on the podcast, just FYI, although I'm going to fix that. They have 5 internal full-time market researchers, and they have over 40 and growing UX researchers. So that user experience is just driving a lot of the decisions that are being made inside of whether it's art, you know, throughout the organization, honestly.
I agree. Yes.
So what is Mesh offering right now that is being adopted and finding a lot of traction inside of the marketplace?
Well, I think it is the ability to be able to measure these experiences. So I think that that's what we're really finding traction with. So, I mean, the data is collected, as we've talked about before. But that is something that when clients see it, because it includes quantitative metrics, so you can draw that lovely pie chart and you can see exactly how people are experiencing the brand, but then you can really dig down and you can see which are the positive experiences. And we know that a positive experience has 3 times the impact of a neutral one on brand consideration. So that's really important to look at that. And you can see that for yourself and for your competitors. So again, you can immediately start to see where there's white space, what you can do, if there are negative experiences, how you can fix them. And so that's what we've been finding, that the data itself, once clients try it, then they get hooked on it because they really want to see what people's experiences are. And there are qualitative comments and photos as well. So, you know, if you know that, for example, posters are performing very strongly, you can see exactly why people are saying that.
My guest today has been Fiona Blades, CEO of Mesh Experience. Fiona, thank you very much for being on the Happy Market Research podcast with me.
Thank you so much. It's been an absolute pleasure discussing this with you.